Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, co-host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Andres Bernard, the author of Theory of the Hashtag. Andres, thanks for being here with me today.
Thanks. Thank you.
So I'm hoping you can start out by talking a little bit about what got you interested in the hashtag and writing this book about it.
Yeah, I think my interest arose at the peak of the Me Too debate, let's say in the winter 2017-18, when in also in Germany, where I live, I would say on every day, couple of newspaper articles and hundreds of Facebook and Twitter postings were dealing with this movement and this hashtag, so to speak. And in Germany and, of course, as well, and especially in the US, I think they have been discussed day by day in hundreds of postings, the ethical and political reasons and the ethical and political content of all that. But what I've never seen, at least in Germany, was somebody who dealt, let's say, with the media technological conditions of this whole movement, or in other words, how the hashtag shaped the whole debate. And you remember that there have been, for example, a lot of statements, at least as far as I knew in Germany and Europe, about the problem, let's say, of the thresholds of this movement. So where there's a certain kind of abuse starts, for example, what could you consider as part of Me Too, what not? And my impression was that the hashtag has a pretty ambivalent or had a pretty ambivalent function in that movement, that on the one hand, of course, it was a very, very precious enhancer of voices. On the other hand, there was a little risk of homogenization, so to speak, that, for example, some nuances or some differentiations of statements were problematic because you all had to subsume it under this one hashtag. And this was the start. And I thought it could be interesting to write kind of a structural analysis of the hashtag as the organizer of public discourse in the age of social media. And that was the beginning.
So you sort of start out by giving a bit of a history to the hashtag and how it came about in social media. So can you talk a little bit about that history?
Yes, of course. I mean, when I started to do research on this short book, I firstly was interested in the fact when has the hashtag been introduced into Twitter, for example, and to Instagram a short time later. And then you have very fast this, you could say, official little history about this, that a product designer and activist in the Bay Area, San Francisco area, called Chris Messina, introduced the hashtag to Twitter in the summer of 2007. And then at first it was a little, you know, the whole system was a little reluctant to use it. But then with the San Diego fires in October of 2007, it kind of was launched to Twitter, and the success story began. And then, as always, you know, as a historian of technology or as a historian of media, I'm always a little suspicious about these very clear, very, very one-dimensional histories of invention. And so I just thought to reconstruct it a little more, with a little more, you know, intensity or a little more precision. And so then I looked around what were the techniques, what were the trials around 2007 to organize the sheer mass of tweets, not only by author, but only by also by topics, by subjects. And so it turned out that maybe what Chris Messina, who is really a very, very good marketer of himself, was Chris Messina claimed as his own singular invention, was maybe one version of a bunch of very many trials, of very many processes of organizing something like the hashtag around 2007. So that's maybe the, you know, that's the first chapter maybe in the book.
Right. And you also move into setting us up with sort of that social media and that history and that sort of complicated history. But also then you talk about it as a symbol and sort of linguistics and looking at the symbol of the hashtag. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you learned about the origins of it as in the United States, what we would call the pound sign.
Yes, yes. I mean, first, you know, what I also was interested in is basically fundamentally about the aura or the power of the hashtag today. And you can figure it out if you, let's say, on a random day, if you go through the street of a city like New York City, where I'm working at the moment, if you go around, you see the sign on the covers of books, you see the sign on the graffiti on walls, you see the sign even as a tattoo, and you know, on all these materials, on paper, on stone, on wool, on skin, the hashtag cannot be clicked upon. It cannot connect anything. And still, it has obviously such a power at the moment. And that's, I think, the interesting thing for me to face the power of the hashtag, which you could say, which brings a promise with it, you know, the promise of connectivity and the promise of bundling voices. And that's what I was interested in. And when you ask what was the, you know, the history and the biography of the sign before that, it's very interesting because at least I didn't know so much about this. And in the US, as you said, the sign was always called pound sign or number sign, and everybody knows the abbreviation. Number 10, for example, with the sign, or 10, and then the sign as 10 pounds for something. And if you read books already in the 19th century, the sign shows up, what you call the hash. And I tried to find out and during my research how this came up. And I think the most convincing theory is that in earlier times when there was no book print, or whether it was more handwriting, you know, in the books of people who were salesmen or who had to write you know, books about their sales. They always used the LB in handwriting, LB with a dash in it as an abbreviation, and this meant pound. And this theory says that decade by decade, year by year, when they all wrote this LB dash in a handwriting in a very loose way, it more and more looked like the hashtag. And this is a convincing history, I think. And so when book print arose and you had to find a sign for this LB with a dash in it, then you created this sign as a character in print, and that's interesting. And so it came up, and then there was a very important year in the history of the typewriter, when the typewriter was invented in the last quarter of the 19th century. Then in 1888 in Toronto, people met for the first Congress of the Universal Typewriter Keyboard, and they wanted to create a standard keyboard, which has not been there until 1888. And then they talked about what signs, except for letters and numbers, should be on the keyboard. And then they decided that the pound sign should be included above the three, like until today. And this was a very important moment, because from that on, you could say the hashtag or the pound sign was part of the inner, you know, the inner standard bunch of signs. And then we could, if you want, we could then switch to the touch tone telephone, which is the next big threshold in the history of the sign.
Right. And I thought that was really interesting too, that because the typewriter had the pound sign, the touchtone phone then incorporated it as opposed to the other symbols it was thinking of using.
Right. And that's so interesting because, you know, I mean, if you are a historian of media technology or a historian of typography, it's always the question why, you know, why some signs have had this big career, so to speak, mm-hmm. and some signs kind of vanished over the times. And that's really interesting because when the first touchtone telephones were created by AT&T in the early 1960s, after a couple of years and the first models of these telephones, and there was the need for two more signs. So you had the figures 1, 2, 0, and then there were two free spaces, left of the zero and right of the zero. And since the telephone in the 1960s more and more was connected to early computer systems, for example, if you wanted to type in your credit card number, or you wanted to be you wanted to talk to your bank to ask some question for your account, and you had to type in your account, then there were two signs necessary. First, a sign to start the process. This was how do you call it in English? In German is Asterix, the star.
Right. Yeah.
How do you say in English? I don't know.
I would probably say the same thing. To start the phone or to start. Yeah, I would probably say the same thing.
I mean the name of the sign. I don't know if
the
other one, the star.
Yeah. Oh, the.
In German, it's Asterix.
Right. Yes, it would be asterix probably that right. same. But some people say star though.
Okay, so you had the star to start the process, and then the engineers of the touchtone telephone thought about what could be the sign for the ending of the process, you know, like the confirmation. Type in your number and confirm with the sign. And in the early, in the first AT&T touchtone phones, it was the diamond sign. And then they wanted to go on market, you know, try to sell the first phones in the mid-1960s. And then they figured out that the diamond sign is not on the universal typewriter. And since you had to fill out so many formulas and you had so many different form of papers, which would be at hand in stores and everything for advertising and for sales. And then the engineer said, no, we have to have a sign which is part of the universal keyboard. And then they decided to take the pound sign. And this is like the big threshold in the biography of the pound sign in the second half of the 20th century, because from then you could say, okay, now this pound sign is really one of the most important signs on touch tone telephones. And then when the internet started for everybody in the early 90s, then it showed up in these, maybe you remember, in these very early forms of chats, which were called relay chats. Mm-hmm. And you already then had the structure that on these early internet chats, if you wanted to start a new subject, you put in the pound sign. So this was already kind of a pre-era of the hashtag. And then when Twitter came in 2006, 1 year later, the hashtag started its career.
Right. And so you give us a sort of history of this symbol. And then you also talk about how this using this symbol impacts the use of keywords in sort of library sciences, as well as sort of organizing things and categorizing things. So can you talk a little bit about this, what has happened now with keywords and sort of that history and how that comes into play?
Yes. I mean, when you asked me before, what was the first impact or the first intention to write this book, I think what this was the second interest that I had the question, how did this new allocation and this new organization of knowledge in digital cultures is driven by keywords and or by buzzwords. And if you remember back, let's say around the turn of the century, 20 years back, what would you say? Where was the keyword? I would say the keyword was something which was not present in general organization of knowledge, but was only something which was there in very marginal contexts. So if you think what you've already said, if you think about the archive or library context, you had the subject catalog or you had the keyword catalog in, for example, university or public libraries, and there you had the structure that keywords organized knowledge. Then another thing, in Germany and Europe, there has been since the early 20th century a subdiscipline called keyword research, in German Schlagwortforschung. I'm not sure how it was developed in the US, if there's something which is called keyword research, but at least in Germany, where it was kind of invented in historiography in the early 20th century, this was the need, you know, to reconstruct a certain epoch, historical epoch, or to reconstruct a certain social movement by keywords. So what is the keyword of the Reformation age? What is the keyword of 19th century democracy research? And then you kind of narrate history in terms of finding keywords. So in these two disciplines, archival library sciences and historiography, the keyword was there, but this was only totally marginal. Nobody was interested except for experts. And then in digital culture and with the development of social media networks like Twitter and Instagram, within a couple of years only, until today, the keyword is the virtual center of organizing statements and documents and knowledge. And I think that's very interesting for a media researcher, because what does that mean? And that's something, you know, in this short book, I maybe just try to lay out in a first step. I'm far away from really having analyzed this in depth, but I just posed it as a question, maybe, and this question is still very interesting for me. What does it mean for a culture if practically all statements on political issues, on cultural issues, on popular issues today are debated by using keywords and by trying to, you know, step up or by trying to accumulate the power of a statement because you use a hashtag or a keyword which is used by so many other people? And that's an absolutely new constellation in the ways how public discourse works.
Right. And so then you bring this into thinking about sort of political activism as well as marketing. And so let's start with the political activism. So you talk especially about the role of the hashtag in talking about, in the United States, police violence and police brutality and a lot of what happens with Black Twitter and Black Lives Matter. And so can you talk a little bit about the role of the hashtag with political activism?
Yes, sure. I mean, you know, this was maybe the longest part of this book, or the longest part of this essay, that I thought to myself, where, in which fields, in which spheres, does the hashtag play the most important role today? And if you, for example, search a database in a library, or if you do a Google search, then something very clear happens, what you have already just mentioned, because you will find out that with the exception of very, very singular little texts, you only have really two big spheres where the hashtag really plays a role in terms of being analyzed and being theoreticized and all that. And the one of these two spheres is political activism. And I think this is a story, and that's the reason why I tried to cut it a little short in this book. That's something which has been analyzed a lot. I mean, if you think back, when does Twitter play a role, or when does the hashtag play a role as something which is kind of focused in a theoretical way, then it's always the so-called hashtag activism. And I tried just to reconstruct this short history in mentioning or in analyzing a couple of very popular events where it has played a role. And as you have just mentioned, I think the most popular hashtags in terms of political activism were hashtags like Black Lives Matter or Ferguson, where of course the very important productive role of the hashtag has become very clear. So if you think about events where white authoritative persons, armed persons, kill unarmed black teenagers, then you can say that both the journalistic and juridical reactions towards these events in mass media, in television, in newspapers, were not very satisfying, were insufficient. And then, of course, a medium like Twitter and a hashtag like Black Lives Matter or Ferguson, which has been used in over 30 million statements until today, is a very powerful tool. And that's what I would say. That's the one you could say. That's the one big moment of the hashtag, that for those who are not represented well in mass media, for those whose voice is kind of ignored or at least disturbed, for those, the hashtag on Twitter can be a site where the own voice can be raised without the filters, without the distorting filters of mass media. And this is, I would say, the role of the hashtag in political activism.
Right. And so you sort of mirror that, or you also talk about the role in marketing, which becomes very different, and the use of the hashtag in marketing. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that a bit. It keeps making me think of right now we have the Democratic debates going on, and we have this big field, and sort of the use of hashtag in politics. You talk about a bit as marketing as well. But can you talk a little bit about that other role and the marketing role of the hashtag?
Yes, of course. When I started this book, I work at a Center for Digital Cultures at a German university, and we have a lot of fellows from all over the world. And this topic of hashtag activism was kind of present in our research at the Center for Digital Cultures within the last 2 or 3 years. And when I listened to these talks, or when I read those papers and the volumes which have been edited with different papers on hashtag activism, I always kind of missed the mentioning of this ambiguity, because there's, for example, a very good, very thick 500-page volume called Hashtag Activism, edited by a researcher called Nathan Rambukana, I think from California, in 2015. And there are a lot of papers, 500-600 pages long altogether, which call the hashtag, as they do in this book, a rebel sign, a rebel part of typography, which can alter the mainstream discourse in politics, which can be an alternative to certain political tendencies. And I always missed when I read this the other side. And I would say the other side is exactly the other 50% of texts, of articles, of instructions which show up if you type in a hashtag in Google or if you type in hashtag in a database. And these other 50% are kind of unknown or kind of ignored by the academic humanities community. And I wanted to, I wanted to give insight in both worlds. And this other sphere, hashtag marketing, I mean, it's very clearly understandable why the hashtag in marketing and in advertisement is so important, because the hashtag gives the possibility to the companies to find a slogan or to not even to create a slogan themselves, but to find slogans, let's say, in the Instagram community and to kind of like pirates, take them and transform them into a slogan of product marketing and let all the people, especially on Instagram, who use this hashtag on their profiles, be a part of this community. And as you know, this kind of marketing has had a special name since 10, 15 years called content marketing. And content marketing reacts to the different media sphere in digital culture. Until 20, 25 years ago, a company had to pay for advertisements in the newspaper or on radio or on television to have some space or some time to do marketing for their products as a separated part of media. Now, as you know, it's totally different. Now, every big company is kind of a media house itself. It has a lot of autonomous channels, like own profiles, like own Twitter, Instagram accounts, like own blogs, where they can act like a publisher. For example, Red Bull, the Austrian company, is the big pioneer of this. And now every company can create a media sphere where advertising is far more subtle. Advertising now means create an atmosphere and content where the consumers maybe feel in the mood that they want to connect to this brand. And so the hashtag, I would say, is the ideal agent of this new content marketing, because it, it accelerates and it accumulates a community of consumers which subsume their comments and their desires under this hashtag. So it's very, very practical. And I think you have to think about the consequences. You have to think if this hashtag, you could say, commodifies language. So the words after the hashtag or the order of words after the hashtag are kind of a commodity, a kind of a slogan, kind of a marketing practice. If this is the case, what does this mean for the usage of the hashtag in politics or in activism? And I think this is a question which is maybe necessary to pose.
Right. And you sort of end this with that discussion. Is this empowering? Is it sort of leveling that use of that hashtag within statements, how people often will use the hashtag to be sarcastic or to emphasize something that they're tweeting about or posting on Instagram, but also then the use of it by companies or other ways to make it more uniform. And so can you just sort of talk about that and sort of the conclusions that you've come to?
Yes, I would say the conclusion, since it's more an essay, it was not my concern really to have this complete, absolutely structured, differentiated analysis. But it was more, since it's an 80, 90 page essay, it was more the matter of asking questions and to lay out some reflections on the hashtag. And I think what was important for me is to lay out this ambiguity or this ambivalence that on the one hand, of course, the hashtag in the last 10 years has been a sign of empowerment, has been a sign where people can unite, where people can bundle statements to let them have more power, more influence, more impact than they would have without it. But on the other hand, and that's maybe even more important, I would say, since you can see even in the few months my book has been published, that it has been conquered more and more by marketing, by companies, by public relations, because it's so seductive that every statement which uses the same hashtag can be used in this way, that you kind of commodify language, that you kind of transform language into advertising, into marketing. And this is what I meant with leveling, what you have mentioned just before, that the hashtag maybe levels language, levels desire, levels statements. And you can always think about, maybe this could be something like a conclusion. The conclusive questions could be, what has the hashtag enabled? It has enabled the amplification of voices. It has enabled the bundling of voices. But you could also ask, what has the hashtag weakened? And I would say it has weakened maybe the uniqueness of voices, and it has weakened the idiosyncrasy of voices. So voices or statements which can't be compared, which can't be leveled, which are just kind of a little weird or spooky or very singular. And so in this ambivalence between empowerment and leveling, the hashtag is out there, I would say, in our digitally organized public discourse, and it's maybe worth to think about it even more in the future.
And so you had mentioned too that this is part. So this is, like you said, sort of a longer essay, and that it's part of a larger book and a larger project. So can you talk a little bit about that and what this is sort of attached to and part of?
Yes, very much. I think in the US, at Polity, the publisher, now two books have been released in a very short period. So maybe 4 weeks before the hashtag book came out, there was the release date of a book called The Triumph of Profiling, which is more like a more in-depth analysis of 250 pages or so. And in this book, I was interested in a little broader question. What is the status of the self? What is the status of subjectivity in our digital culture today? And my starting question was very easy, because I asked, why had 25 years ago, why only serial killers and lunatics had a profile made by police or the FBI? And today, 25 years later, why does everyone have to have a lot of profiles voluntarily? So a format of describing subjectivity or identity, which has been in the history of criminology and psychiatry, a format to describe deviant subjects, has transformed in a very, very fast period of time into a format which is something we voluntarily do to have a certain, to feel more attractive, to feel more socially integrated. And that was my question. And the history of the profile, which I try to reconstruct in this book from the early profiles in psychiatry in the early 20th century to the FBI offender profiles since the 1970s to today, this history of the profile was one thread to write the history of contemporary subjectivity, and the other two threads were the history of localization technology, where you could pose the same question. When was it necessary to localize yourself in space 20 years ago? It was when, you know, the FBI agents put a small beeper under a car to look where the suspicious person will go to, or you put electronic tags on the whistle of the ankle of criminals to look where they are. To our contemporary digital practice, where everybody looks, 50 or 100 times a day on their smartphone to locate themselves in space. And the third thread, of course, very prominent, is the whole quantified self movement, where you could also say, where did it come from that people measure their blood pressure, or measure their sweat, or measure their heartbeat, to find something out about themselves? This is also a technology which came up in the early 20th century in terms of the lie detector. You know, the lie detector in court since around the First World War was invented with the same desires to find out the truth about persons as we try to measure our bodily functions today. But again, with the big difference that the lie detector wanted to know something about deviant subjects, and today it's about healthy, normal, happy subjects. And so that was the approach of the book, to kind of analyze the criminological and psychiatric fundamentals of our contemporary subjectivity, and this big, for me still very, very disturbing threshold that all formats of identifying deviant subjects, lunatics, criminals, etc., are today the model of creating healthy, normal, happy subjects.
Interesting. That's fascinating. So as we sort of wrap this up, are there other things? I know these both just then came out. Are you working on anything else, or is there anything else you want to share about what you're working on right now?
Yes, I mean, I'm very glad that you're interested in my work. I can only say for to whom it may concern that there's also a book I wrote translated in English, which is about the history of the elevator. Totally different subject, but also interesting. You know, before the elevator, all the spaces on the top floors were very scary and for poor people and for illegitimate relationships. And then after the elevator, you had the penthouse, the roof garden, and the chief executive suite. So this is kind of also a book which tries to examine the implications of a technological shift. And at the moment, yes, I try to write a book on something also very, very different. I try to write a book on pinball machines. But I hope that once it's done, it's maybe also translated to the English language, and then you could read it. But this is a more, it's not maybe an academic or scholarly book, but more something like an attempt to narrate my own life as a series of pinball games, because mm-hmm. I've been playing for a lot of years. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Well, it has been wonderful talking to you and learning a little bit more about your work and what you're doing. Again, this is Rebecca Buchanan, who for New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and I interviewed Andreas Bernard, who's the author of Theory of the Hashtag, as well as The Triumph of Profiling. So thank you so much for talking with me on New Books Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mm-hmm.